on the front line of freedom. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our visit with 90-year-old Bob Ashburn of Atwater, California, originally from Torrington, Wyoming. He's a Navy veteran of World War II, participated in 9.5 invasions aboard the destroyer escort USS Tisdale, nicknamed the Lucky T after making it through the entire war. When we left off, Bob was talking about how he and the other young sailors couldn't help but stand up and watch when they got their first taste of combat at Tarawa.
On the shore, the Marines had set up big searchlights, so when those planes would come over at night, they'd search, they'd get them spotted, and then they were firing at them, and we were firing at them too. But at that time, radar wasn't as good as it was later on, but I never ever saw one shot down. But you see the explosion close by them, but that was kind of the setup on that. It was just something new to us, and we wanted to see what's going on. Dumb kids.
Did you hit a point where you said, oh boy, this is pretty scary. I don't know if this is going to work out all right.
Yes, probably by Saipan and Tinian. So we went through Tarawa, Kwajalein, and Eniwetok. Not much problem to us. But when we got to Saipan, then that was another story. They started to lay it on us pretty heavy. And our biggest thing was there, the subs would come. See, because this outfit that we were really watching was this 6 big troop ships of floating reserve. Well, you just can't leave those swinging around for fuel usage. So they'd come in and anchor every day. We'd just cruise back and forth for anti-aircraft and sub protection.
So you are protecting those 6 troop ships. That was the duty of your ship.
That's the main thing we had, because at night we would take those troop ships out, because that's when we'd get the raids mostly, and we just go back and forth, back and forth. But here's the subs over here. They knew they couldn't get in too close to us because, you know, we had the underwater sound gear, and we could sound them, and then flag would say Tisdale, go, and Elise, whichever ones. Maybe 2 of us would leave the convoy and go back hunting those Jap subs. We'd get a sounding. It's something like air radar. A sound goes out, ping, and if it hits something, it bounces back. Then they measure that how long, and it's, oh, they're 1,000 yards out here. So that's where you charge for them. Then we get over there and get the contact on them. We had what they called a 13 charge pattern. There's 4 K guns on each side and 2 racks. So there was 10 setters on those devices. You had to set them up to whatever the sound gear people told them how deep they were. Okay, set for 30. Had a spanner wrench you put on there and set it 30. You had to train in the daytime, because what are you going to see at night? So, but we go click 1, that's 30. Click 2 is 50. Click 3 is 75. No talking between any of those guys, but we had one talker. He'd get the word down from CIC, and that guy would say, hey, change setting to 70, 75. We do it just by listening. Click, click, click. Then you know you're there. The thing was, we thought we'd get them, but you didn't know for sure, because see, if they low down and lay on the bottom, you can't sound them off the bottom. They have to be up where they're a thing. You're hitting them, that thing's coming back. So we thought we had 2 possibles out there. But then next thing they pulled on us, these subs would come in there fairly close and shoot random shots at us and those troop ships. A guy, a good friend of mine, he's 2 decks up on an aircraft gun. He says, Bob, one night I got 2 of those torpedoes coming at us so close. He says, I screamed so loud he thought the whole ship heard him. That size of ship, it's only got about 3/4 inch metal on the outside, and it would just blow you apart. That was pretty damn scary, because they'd shoot them at you, and only the guys up higher could see them, you know, because they make quite a wake in the water. But that's when the first action really started for us.
That was at Saipan?
Yeah, Saipan. Every night, we'd take these spare troop ships out and just go back and forth. Oh, and we're surrounding them, just like we do when we work with carriers. You have to have somebody to get those soundings. At daylight, we'd bring them back in. They'd anchor. If we were assigned anti-aircraft, we'd anchor also. But if we were assigned subbing, we'd just go back and forth out there. But one of these times when we anchored, and then come that evening, Tisdale, get underway. Tisdale, get underway. While we were yanking on that anchor, and all we could figure, it must have hung up on a ship we'd sunk when we went in there. We couldn't get the damn anchor up. So they had to call the shipfitters up there with torches and cut that one anchor off. On the bow of the ship, there's two anchors, one on each side. So from the rest of the war, we went around with one anchor.
And if they hadn't cut that off, you guys would have been stuck there. Would have been a real easy target.
Oh, hey, we'd have been dead targets. Those tubs could have picked us. See, we had a really sharp captain. You don't try and run away from those torpedoes. You try and head into them. Here, you're going this way. These torpedoes are coming this way. So, but if you go this way, you can possibly straddle them. And that was what, boy, our captain was good. And it was the same thing later in the war for that same kind of maneuvering for aircraft attacks. That smaller ship, we had it over those carriers and those guys. On the top of the fact that the Japs wanted to knock out those carriers, they can't maneuver. You know, here's this big, several hundred feet long ship. Say the difference between an 18-wheeler or a car out on the road. The guy can maneuver over. We could maneuver around, and we did. Boy, we was just circling all this kind of stuff. That's on these air raids. But we didn't get much of that until the latter part of Saipan.
You mentioned that anchor there. I know another thing you saw, and maybe you saw a little bit of this at Tarawa, too. Tarawa was such a bloody battle and an often overlooked one, and I guess you guys got there probably on the tail end a little bit, but I bet you saw some of the carnage. And here you are, a teenager. What did you see, and what did it feel like?
I'll tell you, that hurt you bad. I'll never forget it. Damn bodies laying around. Flies all over them. See, at the first, they let us go ashore, you know, get off the ship for a little bit. But that's all you saw. Here's this bulldozer building, digging big ditches and just bulldozing those Japs in there. But the American guys, they had some grave outfit that found out who they were and that. But some of them were so blown up they couldn't tell. You see the in the graveyard there? U.S. Marine, unknown. There wasn't enough of them left to find out. It was terrible.
Can't imagine being an 18-year-old and looking at that and feeling so bad for them and their families, and then probably also thinking that could be me.
Yeah. Fortunately, we didn't have any guys aboard that had relatives in the Marines or that. But some of my schoolmates did. It's hard to say how bad you feel. But basically, we're just hoping nothing happened to us, and it didn't. That's why they called us the Lucky T.
Well, and it wasn't because you weren't in some sticky situations. I know that you were. And one of the notes I know you've written down about Saipan was bodies floating in the water there.
Now, you want to talk about something tearing you up. This is babies and women and so many. We was trying to drive around through them. They were just thick, and you couldn't do it.
Is this where they were jumping off the cliff, below that?
They jumped off the cliffs, and then I guess when the tide come, it would wash them out. But it got so bad, several of the ships got orders to put gunner's mates out there. Stood out there and just shoot into the body so they'd sink, because they was floating there. And I'll tell you, so much of that, it gets out to you. You never forget it. They had those people so brainwashed. I think there was some kind of a word around. To be able to get in the Marines, you had to kill one of your family members or something like that. And they had those people believing that. So here they go. They go down there with their kids in their arms and jump off those cliffs. Then, I don't know however they went, but then we got the assignment one day to take a battleship and escort them past those cliffs. And now this is with these 16-inch guns. Boy, they shoot a projectile out like a ton. And they got 12 of those guns. So what we went by there, and they just start shooting that cliff off to break that cliff down, so they couldn't at least do part of that. But they still had some pretty big caves there, because the next time the assignment come around for the battleship to go around, we didn't get it, but another outfit did, and there were still enough Japs in there that they shot up two of our ships. But that was the only thing they could figure to do. But just to shoot those cliffs down and get their fortifications out.
And you described for us, and people heard the emotion in your voice, how difficult it was at Tarawa when you saw the carnage there. And I'm sure it didn't make you feel very good about the Japanese. But when you got there to Saipan and you're seeing women and children, civilians who are killing themselves because of the propaganda they're being fed about what would happen to them if they didn't, how angry did that make you with the enemy?
After so long, you get a little bit hardened into it. So between Saipan and Tinian, it's about a 2-mile bridge in there. But they spotted gathering of troops over on this shore. So they said they must be going to go back and try and get across and reinforce their guys. And one night, we encountered 2 barges of them and just slaughtered them. And didn't hurt us at all. But you get toughened into it a little bit more. But it didn't bother us that much because of all the things they'd done to us. Oh, because also, we had terrible losses on Saipan. So he says, hey, this little give back.
And you were there, and the rest of us were not. So all of these stories have some value and help us understand how real this was, how taxing it was, what an impact it had on you and the rest of you guys on your ship and on the world. And one of the places you moved on to was Guam. You saw another way that guys could lose their lives in war. You saw a Navy plane that was coming right at your ship?
Saipan, Tinian, and Guam was one operation. I think they call it Iceberg or something like that. I forget what it was. But we worked Saipan first, Tinian, and then we went down to Guam. And what we were assigned down there, artillery support for the Marines ashore. And they had this map, and we had the same map. And they said, hey, give us some support in, you know, X5 or whatever it was. And so we'd cruise up there and just shoot. Because Guam is quite forested and that stuff. You couldn't really see, but they'd say right on or, hey, so much left, right, or whatever. And that's what we do on that. But then every so often we got to go in and get some supplies and stuff. And this one time we was going in there to get the whatever we was going to pick up, supplies and that. But here's these flyboys, you know, they're doing their practicing too, you know, running, boy. And I mean, when I say they just clear your mast, that's what they do. They do their strafing, like we got strafed later on. But anyway, here this guy come by, and boy, was out there looking at it. He was buzzing. Just as he got over us, whatever happened, one wing peeled off, and he punched into the shoes. See, we were going in the harbor, and he's just crashed ahead of us. We got there in just a couple of minutes, but all he had just time to pull some lever to put out a die. It was yellow. We went up there and looked, but hey, he was going at a speed, you know, 300 or something, that it drove him in the water. And there was nothing ever went. But here's a guy, you know, not at war or anything like that. You know, yeah, at war, but not in a battle.
He was just practicing his strafing runs, oh, and then yeah, boom, he's gone.
Just practicing this, and just some damn thing went wrong, and that was the end of it.
You mentioned Saipan and Tinian and Guam. It was somewhere along that path that you had your half invasion, right? How did you end up with 9.5 invasions that you took part in?
Here, between Saipan and Tinian, at this end of Tinian, they had some fortifications. That was the low island where, back in the good Japanese time, they had the farm fields. And then over on Saipan is where they had the big factory. They used the land good because Saipan wasn't much of a place to grow stuff. But that deal was there. So then when it gets down to where it's getting kind of tight to do this, that's when we went and took reserve ships up to the other end of Tinian. And we thought it was an invasion too. We did our usual shore bombardment and that stuff. Then when they put those guys down, and they're all scaled out pretty damn good. Here's the first wave, you know, quite a bunch of guys in those landing boats. So they'd go on there, here comes the second wave, here comes the third wave. I said, boy, they're really going to raise hell with them down there. But we had eyes on that depth charge rack, oh, because we were at general quarters. Oh, I could look right out there and see, well, all the guys on deck could see what's going on. And those boats started turning around. We said, what are they doing? And here, then the second wave, they turn around and come back. Which, boy, they must have really ran into some opposition down there. So they just decided to back up. They get back, and see, the Swabbies weren't in on this thing. The officers knew. But then they told us, hey, that was just a mock thing to split the Jap forces to come and try and stop this end of the invasion. And then up at the other end, the guys were driving down. It worked because then that shortly ended tinny and it wiped them out.
And you mentioned where your general quarters station was. So it's the depth charge racks on the port side. So you're up top side and you could see just about anything, huh?
Oh, yeah. That type of a ship, you're above the water, the main deck about 7-8 feet. You got a good view of all that stuff.
From that perch at that port side depth charge, when you're at Okinawa and the kamikazes go into a swarming frenzy, you probably saw quite a bit of that.
My gut tied up in a knot. Some guys showed stuff outwardly, and boy, they're smoking cigarettes. I never smoked, but they were just puffing on those cigarettes. I don't know what they're getting out of it. I never showed anything outwardly, but my gut was tied up in knots from nerves, I guess.
When the kamikazes came, can you paint a picture for us? Can you tell us what you saw?
Basically, they were after those carriers. I could show you some numbers in here. You know, we're not talking about, like I hear about these few strikes they're doing over in the Mideast. We're talking about several hundred planes a day. Now, the fleet is broke up into so many pieces. Like, let's say when we were working with carriers, there'd be six carriers and about 15, 18 escort ships just all the way around them. The reason for that, whenever they decided to launch into the wind, they had protection no matter which way you turned.
We're learning a lot today, aren't we? And there's more of that to come and more emotion to come. How close did Bob Ashburn come to a kamikaze attack claiming his life? We're going to find out when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.
Woodlawn.
We're not gathered here united tonight because of the name of our teams or of our schools, but because of the name above all names, Jesus.
Witness the true story of a spiritual awakening that saved a high school and shook a city.
Look at the changes to these boys, Owen.
This is what happens when God shows up.
Woodlawn, now showing.